thank you very much. It's always a pleasure to come and give lectures to people. I'm a government civil servant, and of course I'm here to serve the Canadian public. But at the same time, I always like to serve my community, and so coming here and giving a lecture to the physics audience is a double pleasure. And what makes it even better is that in the audience today, I have the honor of having two former graduate students listening to this lecture. And what perhaps is even better than doing very interesting physics is to see that kind of interest transmitted to the next generation and see that excitement transmitted into new and different areas of activity. And it was certainly a great honor that I've had Gideon Humphrey work with me a few years ago, and more recently, Maria Thibault, who is in the audience. And without them, some of this work that I'll be telling you about today would not have been able to be done. So my title of my talk today is Moving Beyond the Current Limits of Time. And in that, I'm not trying to be facetious. I'm actually trying to say that our technologies have now reached a great turning point in the measurement of time itself, and that there'll be a revolution in the next few years on how the time unit second will be realized. No longer will the microwave transition in the atoms of cesium be the definition of the second, but we hope in the next decade or so realize that through optical transitions in laser-cooled collections of atoms or single atoms. So today I'll be talking about our work at the National Research Council on single ion optical atomic clocks and the quest for the ultimate isolated quantum system. Okay, for many, many decades, in fact, for many centuries, the best unit of time was created by this macroscopic object. I think some of you recognize it. And it's the rotation of the Earth about its axis. And so, since antiquity, this was basically the gold standard by which you could measure units of measurement. The Earth's regular rotation, the rise and setting of the sun, the Earth's rotation against the fixed position of stars was the basics of perhaps agriculture, technologies, the understanding of the Earth's position in the universe, and so on. And of course, that's been a great driving force in our understanding of physics and knowledge, because as we go to more and more abilities to accurately measure things, we can see the universe in a much more subtle and well-defined way. However, towards the end of the 19th century, it became clear that these macroscopic objects, such as the Earth's rotation about its axis, or meter bars made of very low expansion materials, have very, very fundamental limits. Because you're dealing with collections, large macroscopic collections of atoms that have very complicated physical interactions, you get to very fundamental limitations. For example, if you might think, well, the Earth's rotation is a very accurate value, but in fact it isn't, considering current technology. The fact that the Earth is like a top, it's slowly slowing down its rotational period by a second every tens of thousands of years. Even in fact, the tidal forces between the Earth and the Moon and the Earth and the Sun cause fluctuations in its rotational period. Even large weather systems on the Earth can cause temporary fluctuations in its rotational period. So it became clear to the great physicists of the day that we had to go from the macroscopic world to the microscopic world in order to go further in our understanding of the physical universe for these physical units of measurement. And so we decided, as a physics community, to go towards these atomic resonances for measurements back in the 19th century, where Maxwell first proposed some of these ideas of using atomic-based references for units of measurement. And so right now, we can use with atoms, we can determine time to parts in 10 to the 16th available right now. And with these single atom optical atomic clocks, we're going into the 10 to the minus 17th and perhaps 10 to the minus 18th in the near future. And so how do we do this? Well, we do this by perhaps one of the most fundamental ways of interacting in the physical world. We interact electromagnetic radiation with an atomic system, and when this frequency of radiation matches the energy level spacing, we know by some means that we've locked this frequency of transition to some sort of fixed immutable reference. Of course, how good that reference is depends on how we do our experiment. So how does that link in with clocks? Well, in order for us to have a very stable clock, we basically need two things. We need a very well-defined oscillator. That oscillator has to be referenced to something that's extremely well-defined, such as an energy level in an atom or a molecule. The second thing is to measure the amount of ticks and tocks of this oscillator. So we have counters in mechanical clocks to do so. In the atomic clock world, what we do is we read out the electromagnetic radiation frequency that's probing our reference oscillator, and by defining the number of cycles of that frequency per unit time, that determines our frequency standard. So for us right now, the SI unit of the second is the time taken by 9,192,631,770 cycles of the radiation corresponding to the Gramsci-Tite hyperfine transition in the cesium atom. So what I'll be telling you about today is that we're going to be taking this up about 10 to the fifth times higher in frequency. No longer are we talking about hyperfine transitions in atoms defining the frequency interval, but we're talking about electronic transitions in atoms, exciting the atom from the ground to excited electronic state using very coherent laser radiation. And this coherent laser radiation then defines the frequency of our oscillator that is stabilized to the atomic system. Now, you have to understand, as we go to higher and higher, this incredible level of accuracies, I think we've now been able to achieve that we can lose only 1 second in the age of the universe if such a clock could be built, that we need to have a very close approximation to an atomic system that's as unperturbed from the external universe as possible. And there are many ways of doing this. I don't really have time to go in all the details of this, but please understand that my little demonstration today will only examine a small portion of the exciting world of frequency standards. One way of doing this is that you take a single atomic particle, a single atomic ion, and hold it in a fixed region of space, and then probe it with electromagnetic radiation. The first problem you face is, how do you hold it? Well, if you make the atom charged, as we do with single atomic ions, we can basically easily manipulate them using electric fields. And so we have these structures known as traps, these electrodynamic traps that we call. Usually they're formed in such a way that there's two N-cap electrodes, you see these hyperboloids of revolution here, and then surrounded by a cylindrical ring electrode. The idea here is that we create a quadratic potential between these end caps and the ring. Now, there's a very famous theorem in electrostatics called Earnshaw's theorem that shows that for any kind of region of space with no charge, you cannot have an absolute minimum of potential in this region. So we can't create this trapping field to force the ion to the center of the trap using fixed electrostatic forces. So what we do is we apply a time-varying field here. And this time-varying field is done in such a way that when we solve the equation of motion of this quadratic potential with an ion of a certain mass, the ion has bound motion within the trap structure. So a way of looking at this, at least in a very coarse way of thinking, is that we flip this frequency fast enough that the ion doesn't have time to react, travel very far across the trap structure between its being forced. You can see at half cycle, it'll be forced away from the end caps towards the ring, and then the other half cycle back towards the end caps. And I have a simulation here, if I could just show you. It's a 2D simulation of what you might expect in a trapping field. I'll just give you a quick explanation. These arrows represent the magnitude of the electric field here. And as you can see by the symmetry, near the center of the trap, there's actually no electric field. which is where we want the ion to sit. This red dot represents a charged ion, and you can see at this point there's a net positive charge on the end cap electrodes, and left and right is the ring electrode. So if we start the animation, you can see the ion is going to be alternately pushed and pulled, and it undergoes bound motion within the trap structure. And I want you to notice two things. There's two parts of this motion, a very slow motion, which is called the secular motion of the ion, and it depends on the ion's inertial mass and the amplitude of voltage and other parameters. And then there's this rapid motion, you see this little modulation, which is called the micromotion. This micromotion has a bigger amplitude the farther away you go from the trap center. So in our experiment, we're trying to hold the ion very gently at the trap center, try to keep it near the trap center as much as possible, and have a least amount of perturbation as we can. And if we can do that, then we have a very simple physical system. The ion in this potential then acts as basically a three-dimensional harmonic oscillator. And we all know in physics that's a very solvable problem. And so in this very close approximation near the center of the trap, we have an ion sitting in a harmonic potential, and that hopefully all its motion is very well characterized and understood. And in this way, we can really attack some of the fundamental uncertainties relating to this problem. Now, I mentioned to you in the simulation this business of secular motion. The secular motion is basically the slow motion, and the amplitude of this motion depends on the ion's kinetic temperature within the trap structure. For our case, with our typical trap structures, we have about a frequency of oscillation about 1.2 megahertz. The micromotion is the driven motion by the trap E fields, and that's about 14 megahertz. So I just want to have you keep that in mind when you think about this trap sitting within this potential well. In our current experiments, we've done away with the old traditional Paul-type trap, because what we want to do is we want to inject laser radiation and shine it on our single ion. And we don't want to do that only in one direction. We want to do it in three orthogonal directions. The reason we do that is for two reasons. We want to cool the ion's motion in all three directions, and we also want to characterize its motion in all three orthogonal directions. You can imagine we're trying to tune this ion to the perfect sweet spot of this trap. And if we can only have one axis by one laser beam, we'll be never able to do this. And so we've come up with this new end cap trap configuration. Here, instead of a ring, you have these two conical cylindrical electrodes that are axially arranged around this end cap electrode here. And that near the center of this trap, you get a very harmonic potential. Outside here, you get very anharmonic behavior. But for our experiment, since we're only holding one single atomic particle, this is a very close approximation to our harmonic potential well that we use in our experiments. So here's the actual experimental realization here, made of MACOR and all nice non-magnetic materials so that we can go down to level of fractions of a nanopascal in our vacuum chamber. Here you see the two end cap electrodes and the cylindrical shield electrodes. Here you can see these metallic posts here. These are DC trim electrodes to provide lateral displacement of the ion inside the trapping, because we can never create a perfect trap. There's always imperfections in these traps, and we have to trim them out by applying these DC voltages to do some nice lateral and axial displacements. Here's the trap in its vacuum chamber, happily at ultra-low vacuum. In this environment, the ion will see mean collision times about one classical collision every 3,000 seconds. So it's a very close approximation to an ideal isolated atomic system. Here you see these two end cap electrodes and this trim electrode. Above it is a metal pillow that contains a mixture of strontium and other materials. When we heat this oven, neutral strontium comes out as a puff, an effusive source. We then photoionize the atom very slowly in the center of the trap. When we see that single ion fluorescing, then we turn off the loading process, and we can see a single isolated atomic particle. Here's a close-up of the two end-cap electrodes and the shield electrodes. And if you turn on the lasers and you do the loading properly, you see this one single isolated atomic particle nicely floating in the center of the system. And it used to be a very heroic measure just to get one atom in the trap, but now we can do this routinely. And in the last few years, we've been able to hold ions, a single isolated atomic particle, for up to 7 days before it gets knocked out by some residual gas atom collision. So up till now, I've been talking to you, how do we contain the ion in the system? But now we want to talk about creating this clock. We need a very, very narrow reference transition. So in this system, we've chosen to work with strontium plus. And why strontium plus is because this system has a very, I would say, benign arrangement of energy levels. The system has energy levels all within the near-infrared or visible region of the spectrum. As some of you may know, atomic ions notoriously have very deep UV transitions, and they're very hard to generate using traditional laser sources. However, in the strontium system, all these systems are quite close by in the wavelength spectrum, and we can directly generate all these radiations using diode laser and fiber laser sources. So how do we do the experiment? Basically, we start off with loading the ion, and then we have to see the ion. It's one thing to load a single atomic particle, but we have to detect its presence. So we use this S1/2 to DP1/2 transition. And for those in the atomic molecular community, you know that's a very strongly allowed transition. So the natural lifetime of this transition is a few nanoseconds. And so we can scatter, when we put a 422 nanometer laser radiation on the system, many millions of photons per second. If we even collect a fraction of 1% of that radiation, we can see the fluorescence from a single atomic particle with very good signal to noise. And this is what's shown here up in this upper graph. This is the strong fluorescence level, and this is the background scattering light level in the chamber. Now, this transition needs to be having a second laser source at 1092 because this atom can radiatively de-excite to this level. And this level has a lifetime of about a second. So you can imagine you can scatter a few million photons per second, it plunks down here, and then your show is over. So with these two radiations on, the ion will continuously fluoresce, and if we detune this laser slightly below resonance, we get effective laser cooling of the ion from its initial loading at 1,000 degrees Kelvin down to about a millikelvin. In fact, we've measured it to be about 1.8 millikelvin. Now we need the narrow transition that I mentioned that was going to be our clock. Well, this S1/2 to D5/2 level transition is forbidden by dipole selection rules, and so it has a very long lifetime of a third of a second. So a transition from this level to this level has a natural line width of about 0.4 hertz at a transition frequency of 445 terahertz, which means it's an extremely narrow transition. It's like measuring the distance from the Earth to the Moon with a fineness of a micron. So it's a very, very, very narrow reference, which allows us to achieve these extreme levels of accuracy. So as you can appreciate, this is a very slow transition. We can make a transition maybe once or a few times per second. We would never see the direct fluorescence from this single atom. So what we do is, We rely on the fact we're working with a single isolated atomic system. So when we create this system in its upper eigenstate, it's no longer coupled to the laser cooling transition, and we see a sudden drop or quantum jump in the fluorescence. And these quantum jumps signal in real time the atom's residency in this upper state of the clock transition. By counting the number of transitions per second, we can see in real time directly, almost with unity detection efficiency, every time we make a transition on the clock transition. And I just want to show you this little diagram again, this little movie here of the single ion in its system. Hopefully it'll start up. Here's our single ion, and I'm turning on the clock laser radiation, and you can see it's going to blink out, come back on, blink out, on. So this is sort of our quantum telegraph signal, signaling that we're actually on resonance on this ultra-narrow transition. And of course, it's a great manifestation of actually seeing quantum wave function collapse in real time. Okay, so this is how we do the experiment in a very, very simple form. I'm not going to go into all the gory details of all the lasers and all this sort of paraphernalia, but just give you a sort of a feel of how this experiment is performed. First, we have our cooling and detection laser. That provides us for detection of the presence of the ion in the trap and whether an efficient laser cooling. We then turn off this radiation and then probe the atom on the ultra-narrow transition. Now, you can imagine, for getting this kind of ultra-narrow behavior, you need a very special type of laser. If you go and buy a laser diode off of the shelf, you're going to have a laser line with somewhere on the order of a megahertz. We want the laser line with a million times narrower than that. So what we do is we lock the laser. We frequency stabilize laser to a Fabry-Perot optical cavity. This is no simple cavity. It's actually a cavity that we've tried to make as macroscopically stable as we possibly could using current technology. In fact, our cavity that we lock to has a finesse of 200,000. That is, the line width of the cavity relative to its free spectral range is a factor of 200,000. So it's a very, very narrow reference line of about a kilohertz wide that we lock our laser to. In addition, this cavity is made of a monolithic bar of ultra-low expansion glass, the same type of glass that's used in advanced astronomical telescope mirrors. This material has a coefficient of linear thermal expansion that goes to zero at a certain fixed temperature. In our case, it's about 6 degrees Celsius. The mirrors are optically contacted to this bar, and in this way, this is our most stable manifestation of a macroscopic object. And this cavity will not change in its average length by less than a Bohr radii over a third of a year when it's properly temperature stabilized. For those of you in nuclear physics, that means it's changing by less than a Fermi in 3 minutes. So it's an extremely stable system on the time average. Of course, there's an averaging time of the optical radiation within the cavity. The thermal fluctuations, of course, provide the ultimate fundamental limit. So with this incredibly stable laser, which is, when locked down to a few hertz line width, is then frequency shifted into resonance with the ion. We then see the quantum jumps in fluorescence using a PM photon counting photomultiplier, and then we build a spectrum up of the line shape. And then that information gives us a frequency servo to steer this ultra-stable laser always in resonance. If you remember our energy level diagram, we had some Zeeman sublevels in the ground and the excited state. And it turns out there's 10 allowed transitions that we can occur. Because the ion that we use doesn't have any hyperfine structure, there's no line at line center that we consider our reference transition. However, we measure the quantum jump rates for symmetric pairs of Zeeman levels, and we make sure that the absolute magnetic field stays stable within the timescale of our measurements. If we zoom in on one of these levels with our ultra-stable laser, we can now see the ultimate line length resolution of our probe laser system. Here you see, basically what you see is a sync function, because we're pulsing the radiation on our single line for a fixed amount of time, and the Fourier transform of a square wave is actually a sync function. So you can see our actual line shape matches extremely well with what we expect theoretically. And for pulses down to about resulting in transform limits around 4 hertz, we can see this very good, reliable line shapes. So that is a resolution of a part in 10 to the 14th. You could never get such type of resolution in the microwave regime. And that current spectral resolution of 10 to the 14th is equivalent to resolving the distance between the Earth and the Moon if you did it as a length measurement, to trying to measure it at the length scale of an E. coli bacterium. So I think this is sort of big grandstanding type talks, but at least it gives you an idea of how these very, very fine measurements of the physical universe are actually occurring at levels perhaps that the human mind has a very difficult level to understand. So I've talked to you about resolution and precision of measuring this ultra-accurate reference. Now we have to talk about accuracy. We want this singlet atom to be basically decoupled from the external universe. We've done that in some ways by laser cooling the ion. The ion is basically so well defined in its position within the trap that its movement is smaller than the scale length of the wavelength probing it, and so there is no first order Doppler shift. However, there are other shifts that we have to contend with: the time dilation shift, the relativistic movement of the ion by its movement in the trap is a contender. The movement of the ion through the electric field of the trap itself is a limitation. There are other subtle physics that I really don't have time to go into today, but we all have to go and attack each problem one at a time to drill down to the ultimate accuracy of the system. And I'm going to only pick one example in my talk today. And if anybody's interested, at the end of the talk, I can talk about some of the other perturbations on a single ion that we've been able to effectively contend with. Now, if I ask you to remember back to my earlier example of the ion in the trap, we said there was some slow motion, secular motion, which we damp out by laser cooling. But there is this other motion, the driven motion by the electric fields, called the micromotion. And this, for over a decade, was our bane of our existence in our ion trap experiment with our original Paul trap that we used. It really, with only one laser beam shining on the ion, we really couldn't tell where we were bringing the ion towards ultimate sweet spot, because patch potentials depositing metal from the oven on the electrodes, or some AC phase shifts between the two N-cap electrodes, or even any deformations in the trap when we built it, will create some imperfections that will shift the ion away from the AC field node. And when that happens, if we probe it with our laser probe radiation, well, what's going to happen is the ion's not going to be sitting there nicely immobile in space. It's going to be driven by the trap frequency in this rather exaggerated animation, so that we create sort of a shaking action on the ion. And then if we look at our spectrum, you not only get the transition of the particular Zeeman component, but at plus and minus the trap drive frequency, you get this sideband component. Now, this is not really wanted, but it does give us information as to the magnitude of this unwanted and unappreciated form of perturbation on the ion. What happens when you have a lot of micromotion is the ion is being driven back and forth very rapidly. So it's becoming there's a time dilation in frequency between the oscillator probing it and its movement, and we can't get rid of that. We also is sampling very high regions of electric field away from the trap center, and that creates start shifts. So those two forms together are a killer for us for high accuracy. So what we do is we probe in all three directions, and we look at these sideband spectrums, and then we tweak the system. We push the ion gently with these trim electrodes back and forth until we find where the ion is very happy. So in this animation, supposing I put a little bit of a positive bias here on the top upper electrode, then this micromotion will be damped out by quite a bit, and then the sideband spectrum gets tuned down. So you can imagine us working in the lab, working till midnight, tuning this ion down, and finally we've gotten to this position where the sideband is maybe a thousandth the intensity of the main transition. And there we're getting down to where these perturbations are at 10 to the minus 17th level. But it gets better than that. And this is a new effect that we realized only a few years ago, is that the micromotion perturbations, this Stark effect, plus the time dilation effect, they're actually very strongly correlated. And so if you write out the total frequency shift, here's the frequency shift in hertz over the oscillator frequency, it's a very simple equation. It's the mean field squared seen by the ion. This is the mass of the ion. This is the polarizability difference of the upper and lower state, which is fixed by the ion itself. And the speed of light, I think everybody's familiar with. And this omega is the trap frequency. So you can see we have a handle of adjusting this parameter. And if this delta alpha naught, this polarizability difference in the upper and lower state, is a negative number, which it is in strontium, we can make the term inside this bracket go to zero. And so we have what is called a magic frequency. At this magic frequency of running our trap, these two effects cancel out to a very good degree. In fact, based on the theoretical understanding of delta alpha naught, we know we can do it by a factor of 28. So by our sideband spectrum, we can go to 2.2 times 10 to minus 17. With this factor of 28 reduction, we can go below 1 part in 10 to the minus 18. Okay, this is a lot of nice theory, and I think we all believe that it's correct. But of course, being an experimentalist, we want to test this out. So Maria Thibault was very kind to lend a few years of her time, and we did this experiment using two different traps. Now, if you imagine doing this experiment with one trap, you could see it's quite complicated, but doing it with two traps, well, that's even a little bit more complicated. So we've worked and worked, and we only had one other trap. This was a very nasty trap. It was a trap that we built in the 1990s. It's a Paul trap. We have only one direction of probing, so we can never null out the complete micromotion of the system. But let's assume that this is a system with bad micromotion, and we compare it with a system we know the micromotion has been really, really well, very carefully controlled. And if we have two probe lasers, which you derive from the same oscillator here, we can see what the frequency offsets of the two systems. And so we went ahead and did this measurement, and lo and behold, we see that as we change the trap frequency in the bad trap, the Paul trap, we can see that we can go from a position where there's no difference between the traps to a position where we can get very significant offsets in the two trap frequencies. And this is this curve here is actually a curve with only one free parameter, that is the mean field squared here. So we can see that the theory actually agrees extremely well with our experiment, which was a very reassuring and very happy result. Now, because of the very limited time I have today, I'm not going to go into all the details here, but all these uncertainties have been dealt with here, and the worst one right now is our black body. The iron is basically bathed by the room temperature radiation from the trap structure and the vacuum chamber, and that provides a fundamental limit to our current understanding of the uncertainties. But this brings us to 2.3 times 10 to the minus 17. So what does that mean on the scale of things? Well, here's a historical plot provided by Fritz Riele in the Physics Viewpoint article last year. These gray squares represent the historical improvement of the cesium definition of the SI second in evaluated uncertainty. And you can see they've been working really hard worldwide, and they've been able to drill down the accuracy down by basically a factor of 10 every 10 years through really incredible developments such as laser cooling of neutral atoms and atomic fountain technology and very careful state preparation. They've been able now to get down to a few parts in 10 to the minus 16 accuracy. At the same time, the optical people were up here, and these red dots mean the evaluated accuracies relative to the SI second of the system. And historically, that was coming down much faster because the technologies were coming online that were enabling the system to become more and more accurate at very high frequencies, which much, much are higher line width resolution. We can split an optical transition at 1 hertz, which is a part in 10, a part in 100, but the poor microwave people have to split the line to a part in a million, which is incredibly difficult, and it's very susceptible to small perturbations. So eventually, this line in around 2005 crossed our cesium fellows, and these green squares represent the evaluated uncertainties of various optical systems. Our new strontium result is right here at about 2 times 10 to the minus 17. And by the end of this the year, we're hoping to be right down here when we evaluate the polarizabilities of the upper and lower states of the transition. So now we've actually surpassed the SI second, which is the current SI definition of time. And so it's very clear that in the next few years, optical transitions will replace the microwave transition of the definition of the second, but it's not clear which system is the best. So there's a bit of a horse race for the next few years to see who is the best in all this system. Well, we have to go and achieve this system and define it as a unit of measurement. But we have to define that unit of measurement relative to something. Of course, we know the evaluated accuracies of the IN are extremely low, but we have to relate it to the SI definition of the second. And as I mentioned to you, the SI definition of the second is a microwave transition. So how are we going to span an optical frequency, which oscillates at a few times 10 to the 14th per second, and make that 10 to the fifth factor span in frequency down to the RF domain? You can't do it directly with electronic measurement techniques. So we have to rely on our friends from the ultrafast domain, and mode-locked lasers, for those who might be familiar with, they emit an endless, infinite train of pulses. And these pulses can be servoed at a repetition rate that can be extremely stable. If you look at that in the frequency domain, that corresponds to a comb of reference frequencies. And if you servo-stabilize that laser to an atomic time standard, then you create a grid of reference frequencies across the optical spectrum. I don't have time to go into all the nitty-gritty details of this thing, but if you believe me that this grid exists, then we take a little bit of this probe laser radiation and heterodyne it against one of the teeth of this frequency comb. We get a measurable frequency beat from that and determine the frequency offset of our probe laser against this reference comb. And in this way, we've actually done the experiment. We take some of our ultra-stable laser diode radiation, we heterodyne it with this frequency comb. That comb is servo-locked to one of the NRC hydrogen masers in our ensemble at 10 megahertz. It's multiplied up to the repetition rate of the laser, which is about 100 megahertz. That maser is then calibrated either relative to the SI second using the NRC cesium primary atomic clocks or through GPS satellite link to all the international ensemble of atomic clocks. And through this, we can get down to about a few parts in 10 to the 15th accuracy. So we can actually calibrate our laser relative to the SI second in this way. Not at the ultimate limit of the ion, because the ion's better than the SI second, but to the best level possible at the present time. So here's our results. This is days. So you can see we can run our clock for a very long period of time. This is a weekend where we don't have many graduate students. So we had to turn it off during the weekend and go home. But imagine that we could do this throughout the week. And perhaps in the next few days, we're going in the second measurement campaign, and we'll do that, for example. So what you're seeing here is the drift of that ULE cavity at 10 millihertz per second, which corresponds to this Bohr radii every third of a year in its drift. That makes the laser probe an extremely stable source of radiation. And so when we evaluate this frequency stability, when we lock to the ion by looking at various Zeeman components, we can see that stability averages down with better and better with averaging time below the 10 to the minus 16th level at over 10 to the 4th per second. When we compare that stability with our measured stability relative to the maser, we can see the maser, which is the gold standard for many, many measurements in astrophysics and frequency standards, you can see these optical standards very clearly outperform these RF standards, even the best masers that are in existence today. So we did measurements over a two-month period, and we've been able to calibrate this relative to the SI second. The statistical uncertainty of this mean value is about 0.1 hertz, but our systematic uncertainties due to the calibration of the maser limit us to about 0.9 hertz, which is 2 times 10 to the minus 15. This is our weighted mean value here, the big red dot. And one of the nice and reassuring things about working in the precision measurement community is that you welcome competition. And luckily for us, back in 2004, a cesium fountain measurement of their strontium clock at the National Physical Laboratories in the United Kingdom was made. And we have very good agreement between the two measurements performed on each side of the Atlantic Ocean. And in 2012, these were incorporated in the new consultative committee of time and frequency to enshrine the strontium as a secondary realization of the SI second. So what can we do with this other than create very accurate atomic time? Well, now we're able to see such very subtle effects of the physical universe that our clock becomes very sensitive even to the most subtle force in nature, which is gravity. As we know by through the theory of general relativity, the time measured by clocks at different heights will show different progressions. Clocks in the deeper gravitational potential well will tick slower than clocks at a higher well. And these clocks are so good now that by moving the clock, one height in height difference will change its relative time by 10 to the minus 16. As you recall, my uncertainty in the system is 2 times 10 to the minus 17. So now we can resolve atomic time to sense gravity using these clocks. And that's what one of our goals in the next few years is, to make an elevator and move one of the clocks relative to the other and just see the change in atomic time. This was achieved by the group at NIST a few years ago in a fixed experiment showing the difference between the two clocks, but we hope to do a more thorough job in this system. So what does this mean? Well, for time metrologists, it's not a happy situation, because now that gravity is being a very big player in this, we have to know where we are above the mean potential in the Earth's potential gravitational. And the Earth is not a perfect solid material. It's got bumps and wiggles, and its mean gravitational potential at sea level is not even uniform. You can see in this plot, this is a geophysical modeling of the geoid, which we call the least mean squared gravitational potential. And you can see even at sea level, you get these very big deviations here. So we have to be very careful in understanding what the gravitational potential is. And I'd like to stress, measuring the gravitational force is not the same as measuring potential. Potential is the integration of all the force across the entire system. So we would have to understand the Earth at a very high level to know what our mean gravitational potential is. If that's not bad enough, the Earth is like a big rubber ball. So as we go around the Sun and we see these tidal forces and the Moon going around the Earth, glacial rebound, changing mass distributions in the molten Earth core, all add to the complications of determining absolute gravitational potential. So these new atomic clocks that are easily going to get into the 10 to the minus 18 and perhaps in the next decade 10 to the minus 19 level are going to have to know the geoid to the centimeter and millimeter level. That's a pretty tall order. So we might say that the present gravitational background noise that we're going to be facing may limit our ability to measure time on Earth. But of course, you could look at it the other way around, and our colleagues in the geophysical world have already thought ahead of us and saying, well, this is a great thing. By using these atomic clocks, we can actually map the geoid using these ultra-accurate measurements of gravitational potential. And hopefully in the next few years, as we make these traps and clocks much more compact and transportable, there's a very big initiative in the European Union to make a transportable optical atomic clock, that this is going to become a reality. So then a clock becomes a tool to measure gravity. In the same sense, we can put the clock in a spacecraft and send it out to the outer regions of the solar system and search for non-Newtonian gravity, relativity tests, and search for hidden Kuiper belt mass distributions. And of course, we can measure limits of gravitational waves at low frequency with these systems. And this was a proposal made to the European Space Agency through a consortium led by Peter Wolf at the Observatoire de Paris. And this system was proposed to incorporate a strontium ion trap for some strange reason, which I have no idea what is. But you can see the excitement and possibilities that once you have this ability to measure time at such a high level of accuracy, you open up a very sensitive measure to the physical universe. So in conclusion, I just want to tell you, Ben, again, that we've been able to measure below the 5 hertz level at a frequency of 445 terahertz, which is part in 10 to the 14th. We've now been able to average down below the best cesium atomic beam fountains in stability. We've been able to perform for days on end of measurements and storing a single ion for periods of over a week. We've been able to measure the absolute frequency relative to hydrogen maser and determine its absolute frequency uncertainty, 2 × 10⁻¹⁵. And we've now quantified this uncertainty to 2 × 10⁻¹⁷, which is an order of magnitude better than the best realizations of the SI second. And of course, that opens the window for interesting science and metrology at the limits of measurement. Thank you.